As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Afternoon. You are tuned in now to Femme Concept on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territories in Vancouver at the University of British Columbia. My name is Eleanor, and I will be your host for the next hour. We started things off today with a track from a band I recently discovered. They are called Post Pink, and they are based in Baltimore, Maryland, in the United States, and that track was called Take Me. It's off of an album called I Believe You, Okay, which came out in May of 2016. Really great things from this band. I'm excited to hear more from them in the future. Today's show is very special because I am airing an interview that I did a few weeks ago with the inimitable Cheryl Hahn. Cheryl is a comedian, academic, drummer, extraordinaire, very talented, very all-around great person. She was in town a few weeks ago because she plays percussion in the band Heaven for Real, who just released their newest album, Kill Your Memory, on Mint Records, a local record label. And when she was here for their record release, I asked her if she would sit down and chat with me about all the cool things she does. And she so graciously agreed. So for the next hour, you're going to hear that interview. We talk about her experience in comedy. She's previously been involved in the Canadian comedian group, comedy group, I don't know, Picnic Face. And she does stand-up. I was lucky enough to see her at Sled Island a few weeks ago, or a month ago in Calgary, and she also plays drums in the band Old and Weird, one of my other favorite Canadian bands. And she's also working on her master's thesis, as if those two other things weren't enough, and it's about Anne Frank. So we'll talk about that a little bit at the end of the interview. A little bit of a topic switch, but, you know, I'm sure y'all can handle it. I also totally pronounced her name wrong, I'm pretty sure, at the very beginning of this interview. So if you're listening, Cheryl, I'm really sorry about that. Or maybe it is Han. I think it's Han. Cheryl Han. Anyways, without further ado, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy. So, my name is Eleanor. I am one of the hosts of Femme Concept on CITR, and I'm joined today by Cheryl Han.
Hey, what's up?
Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You literally just got into Vancouver.
Yeah, we just got off the Nanaimo ferry. It was really beautiful, actually. I really enjoyed it.
Have you been to this part of the country before?
I've been to Vancouver before, yeah. I've been here for Vancouver Sketch Fest in the past, and that's always awesome, but you only see a really small part of the city. I mean, that's the thing about touring in general. You just see, like, the venue you're playing in.
Yeah.
Maybe a couple streets surrounding it, and maybe you'll do one cool nature thing, and then you're gone.
Mm-hmm. So you are currently drumming with Heaven for Real.
Yeah, I play, electronic drum pad, like auxiliary percussion. A lot of reviews of our record and stuff lately have said that I play the bass, and that is not true, for the record.
Interesting. That's kind of weird.
Yeah, and the bass on the record is so good that if I were playing it, being like, what the hell? How did you just pick up a bass and suddenly become the best?
That's funny. Yeah. Cool, and you've been on tour for over a month.
A month and a couple days, yeah.
Wow, okay, nice. And you are here because Heaven for Real is playing a live set on air tonight.
Yeah.
Which is sweet. But I wanted to talk to you because you do a bunch of different things that are all very cool, basically.
I do a lot of stuff.
One of them being playing in Heaven for Real, but as I got to see at Sled Island in Calgary that just happened, you also do comedy.
Yeah, I've been doing comedy for a long time, almost like 10 years, and it's what I actually do. Like, music has just been a really recent development in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy is like what I think of as my whatever, my art practice. Or
cool.
Yeah.
So you've been doing it for 10 years. How did you get into it?
I don't know. I think, like, in high school I had this English teacher who was really supportive of me, and he would, like, volunteer me to host, like, the school coffee house or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started gaining confidence talking in front of people through that. And then a friend of mine who was a year older, when he was 19, he started doing open mics at this bar in Halifax called Ginger's Tavern. It doesn't exist anymore. But when I was 18, he kind of, like, snuck me in, and I did my first set, and
nice.
It went well, so I kept doing it.
Nice.
It could have gone badly, and I probably would have stopped immediately, but no, it was good.
Sweet. Yeah, I was just going to say, like, do you remember your first show? But I guess if it was a good one, then probably.
Yeah, I do remember it. My jokes at the time were so bad, but it was fun.
But it worked out? Cool.
Yeah.
What is it that keeps you, like, what is it that you like about comedy? What is it that keeps you doing it and keeps it something that you consider to be your art practice?
I don't know. I find it's a really good place to tackle, like, cultural issues. I deal with a lot of issues surrounding, like, gender and sexuality, and I find it's, like, a really kind of low-stakes way to deal with that stuff. Like, people are on board because it seems like it's just all a joke, but you can actually sneak in some, like, serious cultural criticism, which is cool. Yeah. Other than that, I think I just probably love attention a lot.
It's an essential part of being a comedian,
yeah,
I imagine.
I think so.
I cannot be afraid of that. And have you been tackling those issues, like, for how long have you been trying to work those in? Is that something you started out doing, or is that something you worked up to?
Definitely wasn't something I started out doing. My initial material when I was, like, 18 was, like, you guys want to hear an impression? And then the crowd would be like, yeah. I'm like, this is my impression of Paris Hilton on fire. That's hot. that was it. That was the kind of joke I was telling when I was 18. Didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got really sick of like, and when I first started out, I told a lot of jokes about sexuality, but in a different way, like kind of in a more vulgar way, because mm-hmm. that's such an easy thing for female comics to do and mm-hmm. get laughs from. If you're like a petite, you know, 18, 19-year-old girl, and then you tell jokes about, like, whatever, dicks, or I don't know, then people are like, wah.
Yeah, totally.
But I got really tired of doing that really quickly, mm-hmm. and I could tell that it was a crutch, so I started consciously trying to write jokes that were, had nothing to do with sexuality, like jokes about the Transformers or, like, the game Monopoly, like, just trying to get away, as far away as I could from mm-hmm. those kind of, like, cliches of, well, what I view as, like, cliches of female comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just started working it back in the more I learned about my own gender and my own sexuality. I kind of knew how to incorporate it back in a way that didn't feel, whatever, like, trite or whatever the word is.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Well, I felt your set at SLED was really fantastic, and I thought it was really interesting how you took this moment to be like, okay, I'm going to do, like, the feminist portion yeah. of my set. How long have you been doing that bit?
I did it last year at Halifax Pop Explosion. So that was the first time. And I don't do it every time I perform. And that actually wasn't the full bit. So the full bit is that I'm like, I'm going to do my feminist material. And everyone's like, yeah, we want that.
Yeah.
And then I go off stage and I get someone to cue up You Ought to Know by Alanis Morissette. And then the crowd's already like, ha-ha. Like,
yeah.
They understand what kind of feminism or like what cultural concept of feminism I'm mm-hmm. going to be engaging with. And then I come out and I just like look at the crowd really angrily and rock out so hard and then rock out too hard and throw up on the stage. And then the crowd's like, whoa, this has taken a turn. and then I'm like, whoa, this has taken a turn. And then I have to deal with the fact that I threw up on the stage and there's this whole thing. And then all of the jokes are just about like, how much I hate men.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, men love talking about their penises, but, and you know why? It's because a man and his sperm have something in common, like each have a 1 in a billion chance of becoming an actual human being. And then I'm just screaming so much and screaming like, am I right, ladies, at the crowd, and turning into a demon a little bit, like,
am I right, ladies?
and everyone's laughing. And then the crowd's so on board by that point that I'm like, oh, you guys are such a supportive crowd. Like, I feel so safe here. And everyone's like, yeah. And I'm like, I feel so safe. And they're like, yeah. I'm like, hey, and another thing that pisses me off is, like, why is it that men are allowed to take their shirts off in public and women can't? And everyone's like, yeah. I'm like, man, this crowd's so supportive. I'm going to take my shirt off right now. And everyone's like, yeah. So I take my shirt off, but then reveal to the crowd that I have attached to my abdomen, like, a parasitic fetal twin. This rig that I made out of liquid latex and, like, a doll. And it's all, like...
Does it look real?
It looks, like, pretty grotesque.
Oh my gosh.
So then the crowd sees that, then they're all like, ew.
What?
And then I'm like, oh, I see how it is. And then I start shaming the crowd for like, oh, you were all on board when you thought I was like a normal woman. But now that you see I have this thing, Gray, like now you're not on board anymore. And I really shame them, call them like, you know, just really go off and shame the crowd. And
yeah.
then I have some friends planted in the audience who, when I'm at my most shamey, they start a slow clap. And then for some reason, the audience gets on board and they start clapping. And I'm I'm like, yeah, that's right, because I'm not the monster. Like, you're the monsters. But then at that moment, I press this, like, syringe I have had hidden behind my back the whole time.
Oh, my gosh.
Because there's, like, some kind of like green tinged soy milk in the syringe that when I press it sprays out of the fetal twin's mouth and just like soaks the whole front row. And
wow.
I couldn't get, what happened was that I bought spirit gum, which is like this props glue that you use to glue things on your skin. I bought it in Edmonton and it just wasn't sticky enough and the whole rig wouldn't stick to my skin. It was like as soon as I let it go, it just peeled off.
No.
And I was like, well, this isn't gonna work.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really go the whole nine
It was
yards.
Still great.
Thanks.
Yeah, it was still really good.
But it's so fun to like like spray the whole crowd, like alienate them so much and then get them back on board.
Yeah, and then just throw them under the bus again.
Yeah, and then ruin their clothes.
That sounds like beyond comedy, like almost like performance art a little bit.
Yeah, I've been told that what I do borders between comedy and performance art, and that's not something I really tried to do consciously. It's just like I like to stretch beyond like the limit of just like set up punchline joke structures. Like, yeah, anytime I can incorporate like a character or mm-hmm. like something theatrical, I just like, I also have a personal obsession with like practical special effects. Like my favorite movies are like The Thing and The Fly and anything Total Recall. Oh my God. Just like anything where grotesque stuff is happening in human bodies and it looks kind of real because it's kind of dark and yeah. everything's really wet. Yeah. So yeah, I just like incorporating that stuff as much as I can because I don't know, it makes it a more immersive experience. Like you see so much just like set up punchline that you're mm-hmm. expecting that, so it's fun to catch the audience off guard and totally. To make them like unsure of what I meant to have happen. Like after the puking thing, people are always like, are you okay, like did you really puke? And I'm like, yes. That's like the best feeling.
Yeah, yeah, totally, that's sweet. How did you find the crowd in Calgary?
Really good. Yeah. Were you there on the first night or the second
night? The second night.
Yeah, because the second night it got weird because my conservative father was in the audience. And he's never seen me do stand-up before.
Oh, my goodness.
And he knows me as a lot of people in my family do, as like a really shy and soft-spoken person. So I really didn't know how he was going to take me, like, vomiting and screaming. But I think he took it well, because it was, like, my dad, who's conservative, and then his, like, even more conservative wife.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, all right, guys, let's do this.
Let's do it.
Like, trying not to look at him in the crowd, but then looking out at the crowd, and there was basically a spotlight on him because of how the room was lit. So it was, like, kind of messing with me. But and then it took a really weird turn because the comic after me, Steph Tolev, who's really funny, she's like a really vulgar comedian, but she does it in this really great kind of like Chris Farley-esque way where mm-hmm. it's like really animated mm-hmm. and really awesome. But she just started, she like saw him in the audience because he was lit up with a spotlight. Yeah. And she was like, are you Cheryl's dad? And he was like, arms crossed, actually, like, yes.
Oh,
and so she really
boy.
Let him have it. Like,
yeah.
She tells this joke about like trying to get to the bathroom really fast as a man with like semen dripping out of your penis, and she's yeah. like, you know what that's like, don't you, Cheryl's dad? And I was like, just like, oh God.
You're just sitting there dying?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I yeah.
And I don't know how he reacted to that because I was too scared to turn around and see what was happening. But yeah, afterwards we didn't talk about it because I didn't want to have to look at him and say anything about sex. So.
Yep, fair. That's I'd say that's a fair reaction.
Yeah.
Sweet. Yeah. Well, I thought it was a nice break at Sled going to comedy and break it up from the music.
Totally.
Like that they kind of tried to, or not. This isn't the first year that they've done that, but I like seeing more festivals try to integrate the two.
Yeah, I think they're a really good fit for one another. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, comedy is a good way to break up a music festival. It's such a different vibe, and you can sit down, which is really nice.
pretty key.
Yeah, and when you've heard so much music, sometimes it's easy to just, like, tune out, but comedy really, like, demands your attention, which is a nice... It like can re-engage you if you're feeling mm-hmm. like you're kind of disengaged. Yeah. It's funny though, because people, even though they're really similar, I think people think about them differently. So like if a comic, like I did a lot of the same jokes on the two nights, I switched up some things, but I did a lot of the same jokes. And I think, excuse me, I think people really look down on that in comics, even though musicians play the same songs every
all
night.
All the time. Yeah.
But it's, like, not thought of the same way, even though it is the same. It's, like, you write your jokes the same way someone would write a song, and mm-hmm. you get your best, like, hour or whatever, and that's what you do when you perform to a big crowd. But, I don't know, people think of it really differently.
Differently. Yeah, they expect a lot.
Yeah. But it's good. It's good to have a pressure on you to always write new material, because then, mm-hmm. then you... do.
Where do you look for your inspiration for what you write your jokes about?
I think just like the culture that we live in, mm-hmm. like North American culture is a big point for me. like gender dynamics. I find that stuff really interesting. And it's fun to play with those things on stage, like play with people's expectations about what it means to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I don't know. I just like, usually I'm really bad at like sitting down with a pen and notebook and writing jokes, unless I'm given like, some shows are really great because they give you like a topic. They're mm-hmm. like, the topic this week is like, whatever,
mm-hmm.
soup. Like, get out there okay. and write your 15 minutes about soup
jokes.
And I'm like, all right,
yes.
like this will help. It's like when you write a paper, if you have a topic, mm-hmm. it's like great. But for the most part, I'm bad at sitting down and writing, so it'll be like I say something and it makes all my friends laugh, like I'll say like something observational or whatever, and then if it makes a lot of people laugh when I say it, I'll like squirrel over to like a corner of the room and jot it down in my notebook, and then later I'll sit down with it and see if it could actually develop into something that could connect with a larger audience, because cool. there is a difference between what makes your friends laugh and what makes a crowd laugh, because your friends will laugh at a lot of things you say based on like them having known you for a long time and
yeah.
the context of like who you are and experiences you've had together. But yeah, there has to be something universal in a joke for it to really pay off for mm-hmm. a larger audience. Like,
yeah, that's a nice story.
I'm turning this into an ASMR relaxation.
Do you do that for real?
Yeah, I do.
That's so awesome.
I'm trying to start my own radio show on CKDU, which is our university radio station at Dalhousie in Halifax. I pitched them like a late night relaxation ASMR show.
Sweet.
And they were into it. But I feel like it should have a disclaimer that's like, don't listen to this while you're driving.
Oh my gosh, yeah, seriously. Yeah. Bad late night. Oh, yeah. One more question about comedy.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if, like, throughout your experience, have you been put in situations or do you feel like sometimes, like, as a woman or, like, because you do talk about gender and stuff, like, are people expecting that kind of, like, feminist bit?
I think people do expect feminist material from women comics right now because of the kind of cultural climate, which is part of why I do that bit where I'm like, these are my feminist jokes. And then it's just off base for what feminism actually is. Yeah. It's just angrily hating men.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people think that that is what feminism is. So that's part of what I'm trying to get at, too.
It's true.
But yeah, I do feel like that expectation is there. And I find that kind of frustrating because I struggle a lot with my own concepts of what my own gender is. So that expectation, like, really complicates things for me, I guess, even more so. Mm-hmm. But it's like, as a female comedian or like a femme comedian, you want to be able to express that stuff when you want to, I guess, but you don't want that to be the kind of linchpin of your comedic identity. It would be nice to be able to eject from gender completely and just be a person who's funny rather mm-hmm. than always having to have it be hung on your femininity.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I do bring gender into my set a lot, but it's also because, like, I'm studying gender theory in my master's degree, so
yeah, it makes sense.
So it's just like my realm of knowledge either way. But yeah, it is nice, or like the goal is kind of to be able to eject from the gender binary, whether it's in performance or just in your lived experience. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, if I can deconstruct it when I'm on stage, then I feel like I'm making a step closer to that, but I don't know.
It's a fine line, I find, sometimes in doing the show that we do. It's like, are we making it worse by, or not worse is the wrong word, but like sometimes it feels like we're going against what we ultimately want by being like, oh, we're going to put all the women in this 1 hour
right.
and like do it here. And I mean, CITR is a really good station. Every show has to play a certain amount of FemCon, which mm-hmm. is really great.
That's
but
awesome.
Yeah, you're kind of like, should I just, like, do I need to make this a statement and say, yeah, we're going to play like 100% FemCon and really just like drive it home? Or should we just do it because that's actually like the music that we like
yeah.
and not necessarily have to be super explicit about it? Like, you can't, it feels like hard. Sometimes I have trouble choosing between one
yeah,
or the other.
I think it's a really difficult thing to navigate, but I think ultimately it's good to create spaces for women and women's art, like, no matter what. So I think that you're doing a good thing.
Thank you. Speaking of our show, the Femme Concept, on the show that I did earlier today, I played a new song from Old and Weird.
Yay.
Which is the band that you are currently drumming in.
Yeah, I drum in that band for real, on a real drum.
Yes.
On a real drums.
I cannot remember the name of the album because it's really long and weird, but
it is really long.
It's great. The song I played was called Welcome to My Home, Suzanne Vega.
Oh, yeah. That's one of Hannah's, the bass player, Hannah's songs.
Oh, so fantastic. How long have you been playing with them?
About a year now, maybe a little bit more than that. When the band started out, it was a four-piece, and then their drummer left to pursue other things. So they were kind of doing a rotating lineup with all of them switching instruments. But I think that, like, Allie and Danny, like, love playing the guitar, so it's nice to be able to focus on that.
Mm-hmm.
So they just asked me if I would drum with them, and then I didn't stop drumming with them because they're, like, some of my best friends, so.
Mm-hmm. Everything that Old and Weird makes is, I love it. It's so great.
Yeah, I liked the band a lot before I was ever in it, which made it kind of weird because it was like, oh, now I can't listen to the music anymore.
The same, yeah.
Or like, now it's weird for me to wear my Old and Weird t-shirt.
I've seen artists go on stage wearing their own merch.
Yeah, so. In a way, I kind of think that that's pretty funny.
Yeah, it works. I mean, if you don't want to wear it, then why should anybody else want to
wear
it?
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, when I'm on tour, like right now, I've been wearing my Nap Eyes shirt a lot, mm-hmm. and I brought a Monomyth shirt. It's just nice to, like, rep your friend's band.
Yeah.
And maybe someone will be like, what band's that? And I can say, but mostly with the Nap Eyes shirt, people are like, Nap Eyes, because now Nap Eyes is like blowing up.
Yep.
So everyone's like, I love Nap Eyes. And I'm like, this is very weird for me, but it's so great.
How do you find the, like, music community in Halifax?
Oh, it's the best. It's like, I would say that the era of all of, you know, going out every night and seeing all of your best friends play all on the same show together has kind of come to an end. Like, a lot of people have moved to either Montreal or a few to Toronto. Mm-hmm. But when it was at its, like, peak, it was just like, I don't know, it felt like you were always wrapped up in a nice warm blanket of friendship and music. And then also, everyone was creating such amazing stuff that you didn't want to be the crappy friend who wasn't creating cool stuff. So I think, like, part of why I do so much or whatever is that I see people around me creating such awesome stuff, and I'm like, I want to try that.
Yeah.
And I just have this, like, whatever, like, life philosophy that if you want to try something, you should just try it. And it doesn't matter if you're good at it or whatever. It's just like, I don't know. Art is so open, and if you want to do something, you should just do it.
Totally.
And then maybe in a few months, you'll be like, that wasn't for me, but maybe you'll keep doing it for 10 years.
Very true. And if you don't do it, you'll never know.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that how you started drumming?
Yeah, totally. So my partner, Nathan, is the best drummer that I've ever seen. He drums in heaven for real. So if you hear us playing, you'll be like, wow. He offered to give me a lesson.
Nice.
And he gave me one lesson, and then I was like, I got this. And then I joined like three bands. I was like, I'm good.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just, like, I don't know. I guess I had like a knack for it. I have a really musical family. Like, my mom and sister sing like angels, and I sing like a troll under a bridge. But also, I have, like, uncles who drum and play guitar, and I don't know. I love to dance so much, and I feel like drumming and dancing are really similar in the sort of, like, skill set that they use.
Totally.
Yeah.
My favorite thing is watching drummers that almost are dancing while they're drumming.
Yeah.
I feel like Nathan kind of does
that. He does, for sure. He's, like, very loose. I want to get to that place. It just... Drumming is so funny. You almost have to go on autopilot while you're drumming, because if you even think for 1 second about what comes next, you will mess it up. Or at least that's been my experience. Or if I think, like, no, don't you mess up, I'm immediately like, oh, crap.
What's happening?
Yeah. Now I'm messing it all up.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's such a weird... It's so funny because people are always like, I could never do comedy. Like, it seems like the scariest thing. But for me, it's such second nature now. And it's like playing music that I find so intimidating. And I don't know how people do it. When I'm playing the drum pad, I just look at the floor or the drum pad, and I never even look up. It's like, I know exactly what I'm playing and I don't need to look at it, but I'm just like, don't look anyone in the eye right now or they will see the fear. If they can't already smell it.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I can't tell when you're playing. You look pretty peaceful at, I think it was at both the Mint Showcase and the local 510 show. You look like you were just, like, hanging out.
Yeah.
A nice time.
There are some parts in the set where I'm literally just hanging out. Like, there's one song where I have, like, two parts, and it's, like, a six-minute song. So I just will, like, sip a drink and, like, look around, see if I can see any birds.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's sweet. Do you find that there's, like, things about comedy or, like, drumming that, like, have positively reinforced each other? Or are they kind of really separate in your brain?
Yeah, they're kind of separate. It's funny because, like, I'm also a, like, career academic by this point, and I find that comedy and academia have a lot of crossover. Like, I started teaching my first classes, like, first year English classes this year, and comedy was so helpful. Like, breaking the ice off the top was so good. Sometimes, warning, sometimes sarcasm doesn't go over very well, and you probably hurt your students' feelings a little bit, but, but it's fine. But drumming is just, like, I don't know, it's so new to me that maybe I'll start seeing the similarities or feeling the crossover, but for now it just seems like this weird alien planet I've landed on.
Cool. Well, the last thing that I want to ask you about is your thesis that you're currently working on. It's about Anne Frank.
Yeah, I'm doing a queer reading of the Diary of Anne Frank.
So cool. I've tried to somewhat explain this to like a few people now who I've talked to them about SLED.
Yeah.
And I've just butchered whatever it is. Like, I'm like, and they're like, so she was gay? And I'm like, well, no, that's not really the point. Anyways.
Yeah. So, yeah, to start off, I'm not trying to say that Anne Frank was gay, just that, like, no one has even thought that maybe she was. So,
yeah.
And in the diary, like, there is a passage where Anne Frank talks really explicitly about her queer desire for her best friend. And she says that, you know, during a sleepover, she was like, as proof of our friendship, we should touch each other's breasts. And her friend was like, I don't know, Anne. But then she says also that they kissed. And she says that whenever she sees a female nude in an art book, it sends her into ecstasy. And she finishes the entry by saying, oh, if only I had a girlfriend. And I read that and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I was like, how has this not been the atomic bomb of like Diary of Anne Frank analyses?
Yeah.
So I looked through all of the literature that I could find and didn't find anyone talking about it in an academic context. Like, I found some people talking about it on Reddit, but then it always just devolved into, like, homophobic anti-Semitism. And I was like, all right, this is not official literature.
Yes.
So I just started, I don't know, thinking about, like, why that has never been picked up by scholars, or like why it hasn't been like a focal point in any way. So I've just been looking at like reasons why. So the way that the diary is edited is like Anne Frank's queer confession is sandwiched between these two super like heteronormative passages, one where she talks about being a mother in the future and one where she talks about for the first time her romantic feelings for Peter Van Dan, who she's trapped in the attic with. And so it like really obscures the importance of the possible queer reading of the passage, because these two passages kind of imply her eventual entry into heterosexual reproduction. So people just automatically view her queer testimony or any possible like lesbian desire as a temporary kind of detour on the inevitable path to being straight and having children and getting married. And that's just kind of a common tendency in the way we view lesbianism anyway. So I'm looking at that. And then I'm also looking at like why you would want to suppress her queer desire. So I'm looking at a concept called epistemic injustice, which is the idea that we give certain groups of people less credibility as witnesses when they testify because of conscious and subconscious stereotypes that we hold about those groups. So since Anne Frank is already a woman and Jewish, she's already in a kind of epistemic double jeopardy where her testimony wouldn't be taken as very valid. And then if you added queerness, it'd be like, bleh.
Yeah.
And her testimony is one of the most important Holocaust testimonies out there, so you really need to like preserve it. And I'm also looking at the concept of the child witness, so why scholars would want to degender and desexualize Anne Frank so that she's this like perfect, iconic, innocent victim who stands as a symbolic representation of the innocence of all Holocaust victims. This interview is taking a turn.
I appreciate you breaking that down. Like,
it's helpful for me because I still need to finish writing it.
Yeah.
The more I can say it out loud, the better. So, yeah. The most interesting part for me has been looking at why scholars still assume that Anne Frank was straight, which, I mean, maybe she was, but it's like, it's just such a locked in assumption.
Totally.
So people always take her relationship with Peter Van Dan as proof that she was straight because they had this romance in the attic.
Mm-hmm.
But I was doing research for a paper the year before on lesbian relationships in concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
And people said that, you know, the women kind of got that way from being locked up together. So, like, being in close quarters and under extreme emotional stress led them to have these relationships they wouldn't have otherwise had.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at why that scrutiny is applied to lesbian relationships but not applied to Anne's relationship with Peter, even though it took place under emotional duress in extremely close quarters.
Yeah.
So it's just funny how we just assume everyone's straight. I mean, that's the ultimate point of the thesis, is, like, we just assume everyone's straight. straight all the time.
Yep.
Especially when they're like an important figure. And especially probably when they're a child figure, because we don't like to think about children and sexuality together even at all, let alone queer sexuality.
Totally.
Yeah. So if you want to cut the interview off before I launch into that, feel free.
I mean, it was when I met you in Calgary and you talked about it a little bit, I didn't know that there had been I didn't know that they had edited the book so severely and then reprinted it. I think like that itself speaks to like a lot of the censorship that you're talking about.
Yeah. The like 1949 or like 53 edition, there are so many editions, had so much of her sexuality and like kind of like gender talk. Like she talks really explicitly about her own vagina and like her looking at it and navigating it, and talks about her clitoris and like all of the stuff that wasn't put in until they re-released the unedited version in 1995, like 50 years later.
Nuts.
So you're like, hey, why did you want to keep that out? And then you just have to think about all these like cultural historical factors of why you would want to suppress the fact that someone might have been queer or
Damn. Well, yeah, that's so cool. I wish you the best of luck on that.
I'm going to lock myself up in our hotel room while we're here and just write for 48 hours straight.
Sounds like it's going to make some interesting results.
Half of it will just be me talking about, like, a movie I saw with, like, Pauly Shore.
Oh, man. Cool. Well, yeah, I mean, I have to say, as somebody who just graduated and is like about to go into probably a few years of freaking out about what I'm gonna do with myself, it's very inspiring to see somebody who balances a bunch of different things.
Thanks.
You know, it's cool because I feel like the world likes to tell you that you know, if you choose academia or you choose music or art or like, you know, it's like, what type of person are you? Like, let's put you in a box so we can like figure it out, or even like the people in your life. And it can be really easy to feel like you do have to just like follow.
I've struggled with that so much. It's always like I was supposed to move to Toronto this year to pursue comedy, and then I got offered a funded PhD position. So I was like, shit, like now I have to choose. Like I have to choose again. I keep coming to these crossroads where I have to pick. I feel like I have to pick one or the other. But the reality is that the other things still remain open as long as you consciously make time for them in your life.
Yeah.
It's like when I was a teenager, my English teacher gave me a copy of The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath because I wrote a really angsty poem for a poetry assignment. And he was like, you should read this. And I was like, thank you. When I read it, I was so grateful because it was amazing. It was like reading Catcher in the Rye, I imagine, for girls. Like, you're like, yeah. And there's this scene where she describes, like, thinking about the future, and she envisions it as, like, sitting. She says, sitting in the crotch of a fig tree, and you look up and you see all these big, juicy figs that beckon and wink, and one is a career as like a woman in advertising, and one is being a mother and having children, and one is something else. And she just sits there looking up at them, and they all look so good, but she doesn't know which one to pick. And while she's looking, they all start to rot and fall off the tree. And I've always been like, oh my God. But then when I feel like I'm at these crossroads, I'm like, this is the fig tree. Yeah. Like I feel like is a real thing that you have to deal with. Like like picking a path, but it doesn't matter.
If you want to try something, just go do it.
I believe it's like a flat earth. It's like flat earth theory. There's no paths, just one big plane.
There's no right or wrong, just the choices that you make. Cool. Well, I'll let you get out of here so you can set up for your live set.
Sweet.
Thank you so much for chatting with me.
No, thank you for having me on your show.
So stoked to turn down all my laughter as I made the mic clip. Cool. So people can obviously listen to Old and Weird online. They have Bandcamp as well as Heaven for Real.
Yeah, we all have Bandcamps. My stand-up is hard to find online. I guess you could watch old Picnic Face videos if you wanted to. But I have a YouTube channel, but I only upload, like, I think my last upload was me painting my face green and saying lines from the movie The Mask. But if you want to watch that, you can just look me up on YouTube.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks so much.
Okay, no problem.
With summer encroaching, I, the sun, attain the height of my powers. Now I will pass solar judgment on this pitiful city. Forests, burn! Ocean, burn! Yoga Fest, burn! What's this? Discorder Magazine. Ooh, ah.
Discorder's July, August, Summer issue featuring articles on Leisha Sets, Tempest, Eileen Bryant, Gal Grayson, and an art feature by Puppy Teeth, plus much more. Find Discorder around Vancouver at cafes, venues, record stores, and online at discorder.ca. Special thanks to this month's advertisers, the Astoria Audio Pile, Davy Street Party, Don't Argue Pizzeria, Hastings Crossings, BIA, Castellano Block Party, Live Van, Pressing Matters, Redgate, Reggae Fest, the Rickshaw Theater, the Rio Theater, Rifflandia, Shindig, Victory Square, Vinyl Records, and Zipcar. It's not getting any zippier than that.
This alone shall be saved. As will the rest.
Join us for the launch of Art Talking Women on Friday, June 10th at 7:30 at Vivo Media Arts Center. Vivo and Cinevolution bring you a series of intimate interviews based on the artistic process and thoughts on community plus technology. Art Talking Women showcases Canadian female artists to the world. The 13-episode series airs every Friday at noon on Vimeo, iTunes, Vivo's website, as well as Cinevolution's website.
Tune into Post Rock Friday from 10 to 11 with your host, John P., for the best in post rock, drone, ambient, experimental, and noise.
You are tuned in now to Femme Concept on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territories in Vancouver, BC, at the University of British Columbia. Show you are tuned into is called Femme Concept. My name is Eleanor. I am your host. And you just heard an interview that I did with Cheryl Hahn, a comedian, drummer, academic extraordinaire. What a person. So stoked that she came here to sit down and chat with me. The music that you heard in between our interview segments, I thought I'd break it up for you so it was a little breakup between the talking. Those were both Old and Weird songs, the band, one of the bands that Cheryl drums in. The first one was called Welcome to My Home, Suzanne Vega, and the other one was called You Idiots Talked Me Into This. And they're both off of a little album that Old and Weird just released. The title is very long, but if it's shortened, the title is Oh, It's You, Through the Door, Coolness of One, Square Shape of Another's. And you can find that on Bandcamp at oldandweird.bandcamp.com. You can find Cheryl online if you want to look at some of her old comedy stuff. Her Twitter handle is Cheryl Hahn, H-A-N-N. And go look her up. She's a funny person. Don't go anywhere. We've got Radio Zero up next, followed by Nardwar at 3:30. It's going to be a great afternoon. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'm going to end things off here with a track from local Vancouver band called Fuzzy P. This track is called Tomato Guitar, I think. Yes. And it's off of their album On a Lawn, which was released back in June of 2016. I hope everybody has a fantastic weekend, and until next time.